This is All Things Considered from NPR News. When it comes to Hollywood trends, this season, fairy tales are in. The movie release schedule is filled with fairy tale remakes, and not one but two new TV series, starting within a week of each other, are based on fairy tales. ABC unveils Once Upon a Time on Sunday, and then next Friday, Grimm premieres on NBC. NPR's Neda Ulaby took a look at both, and she wondered why fairy tales are making such a comeback.
Maybe because of Harry Potter and Twilight. Just think about how much they'd have to pay Stephanie Meyer for a Twilight TV series. But fairy tales are free. Grimm is the show that starts next Friday. It's produced by Todd Milliner and David Greenwalt, who was selling the show to fans at San Diego's Comic-Con last summer.
Todd had an idea in the shower about 6 years ago, and his idea was, what can we do that's in public domain?
Fairy tales' cost-effectiveness is great for financially fearful studios, premiering expensive dramas with high production values and special effects. Grimm is named for the Brothers Grimm. They're not just writing down fairy tales in this show. They were the first criminal profilers with mystical abilities. When they looked for child molesters, they saw evil wolves and gingerbread baking witches. The show's about one of their descendants, a police detective, who learns he's inherited their powers from his aunt.
We have the ability to see what no one else can. When they lose control, they can't hide, and we see them for what they really are.
Grimm is Law and Order meets Little Red Riding Hood.
What do we know?
Little girl on the way to her grandfather's house and showed up.
Now, if Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm magically had a television in 19th century Germany, they would have been completely baffled by this interpretation of their work, says Maria Tatar. She's a Harvard professor who studies fairy tales and legends.
The Grimms, of course, would have been horrified. They were the two scholars, two philologists, who were just trying to capture the voice of the people.
And not like this.
Hank, I got him!
Tatar has taken note of the flood of fairy tale adaptations, from last spring's Red Riding Hood movie to upcoming competing adaptations of Sleeping Beauty and Snow White. She believes this is partly because she sees her students sitting around in big groups texting.
For that reason, I think we need the melodrama of stories. There's so little affect in our daily lives that we need the sensory overload, the emotional overload of fairy tales more than ever.
Putting fairy tales on screen goes back to cinema's earliest days. Tatar mentions an 1899 movie version of Cinderella. You can see it on our website. And she says fairy tales have always been grown-up entertainment in one form or another.
Consider the Cinderella story, which appears in 2 weeks' notice, Pretty Woman. For example, when Julia Roberts goes shopping, she marches into a store with two evil stepsisters.
Look, I got money to spend in here. I don't think we have anything for you. You're obviously in the wrong place. Please leave.
Stories like Cinderella and Snow White are the foundation of a new ABC show called Once Upon a Time. It begins with a curse.
Sorry I'm late.
When an evil queen storms into a castle to disrupt the literally fairy tale wedding of Snow White and Prince Charming.
It's the queen! Run!
She's not a queen anymore. She's nothing more than an evil witch.
No.
Developing backstories and character arcs for, well, archetypes, was the job of Once Upon a Time executive producer Edward Kitsis.
You know, the evil queen can't just be evil because she's evil. She's, you know, she was made evil. In fact, she's much more tortured and sad than she is just pure evil.
In the show, the curse brings the evil queen and Snow White to the real world as real people. They've forgotten their actual identities. Snow White is a lovely young schoolteacher who has no idea that's who she is, even though bluebirds flock to her classroom window adoringly.
If you love them and they love you, they will always find you. We'll pick this up after recess. No running!
Adapting fairy tales can be treacherous. They can come across as corny, campy, or childish in a culture that loves its snark and shock. But Harvard professor Maria Tatar says you cannot argue with their primal symbolism, and all kinds of stories can be fairy tale-like.
I always think of, for example, the Dominique Strauss-Kahn story. We couldn't stop talking about that because it gets to the issue of innocence versus seduction.
Sitar says the next Hollywood fairy tale adaptation she's most looking forward to is Hansel and Gretel. Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters is coming out next year. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Parks and Recreation is a comedy about small-town bureaucracy. The deputy parks director of fictional Pawnee, Indiana, is Leslie Knope, played by Amy Poehler.
You know, government isn't just a boys' club anymore. Women are everywhere. It's a great time to be a woman in politics. Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, me.
That was from the show's pilot. The program is now in its fourth season, which finds Knope running for city council. She does what many real-life political candidates have already done in this election season. Knope writes a book.
I wrote it as a reference for myself, but then my campaign advisor said we should make it a big, wide release. So we had people contribute, and we added pictures, and we removed a lot of my poems and emotional ramblings and pictures of unicorns, and here it is!
Pawnee, the greatest town in America, is now in real-life bookstores. Amy Poehler recently joined us to talk about it from the set of Parks and Recreation in Studio City, California. I asked her why she's so often drawn to political humor, both on this show and when she was a cast member of Saturday Night Live.
I worked on SNL for so many years, and I started my career there at a time when people thought we could never be funny again.
Right after 9/11, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then I ended my career there playing Hillary Clinton during a race that everybody was watching during a time when the country was really paying attention to politics. So switch over to Parks and Recreation, people's interaction with government is usually not on a macro level. It's not a presidential election. It's going to the DMV. It's figuring out who's going to open up a park in their town or, you know, who do I complain to about my curbs being too high.
When the show started, President Obama was coming to office and the country felt very positive despite the terrible things going on. Has the show had to change as the country has become so much more cynical about government in the last few years?
Well, it's interesting because we had an arc on our show where the government ran out of money.
Okay, you need to understand that just to keep this town afloat, we probably have to cut the budget of every department by 40 or 50%, okay?
Well, but Chris said that you just had to, you know, tinker with things.
Yeah, he said that because that sounds a lot better than we're going to gut it with a machete.
So the Parks Department was so low on the totem pole that everyone was afraid they were going to lose their jobs. And it was created by taking the temperature of the country and everyone all over the United States, like, realizing that opening a park or getting a playground built was a low priority, unfortunately. Everyone was trying to save their job. So, yeah, the show has changed. But people watch our show and they think it's a red state show. And then other people watch it and think it's a blue state show. And I think there's something fun about the politics of the show aren't very clear.
You know, the show often brings in national political elements of the conversation. Let's play this clip from a recent episode.
No matter what you heard, ma'am, the truth is I was born here.
If you were so born here, then where's your birth certificate?
Well, I don't carry my birth certificate around with me.
Why? Because you're hiding something? You should go back where you came from.
I am back from where I came from.
That sentence was confusing. You might as well be from China.
That's ridiculous.
Is it?
I'm from here.
Okay, so there's the birth certificate controversy in Pawnee. What do you see happening in politics now that you expect we'll be seeing in the show in the coming weeks and months?
This season, Leslie's running for office, and she has to decide how she's going to run for city council and what that means as far as placing ads, giving speeches, what kind of person she's going to have to become. And we were just talking today about Leslie making her first campaign ad, and the first one she makes is so encouraging and positive, she actually forgets to remind everyone that she's running for city council. And her advisors are like going to have to get a little bit more dirty. So there's a lot of fun with that, about getting into the mechanics of how a campaign is run on a much like smaller level.
Did you spend much time in small town America growing up?
I was raised in a very blue collar town outside of Boston, Burlington, Massachusetts. Both my parents were public school teachers. And then I lived in Chicago for a few years and got a sense of kind of that broad shouldered, windy, stern, Midwestern, warm slash passive aggressive wonderful. Every adjective I can think of.
I think very warm cold, slash passive aggressive is pretty good.
Warmly passive aggressive.
Did you ever go to Indiana as this show was in production or as you were beginning to work on it?
I did. I used to had a job catering. I catered a wedding for the Smashing Pumpkins bassist in Indiana. And I served Billy Corgan shrimp off a tray.
That's insane.
It is. And I said to myself, 15 years later, I'm going to talk about this on NPR.
Does he know that you were his caterer now that you're famous?
He doesn't yet, but I'm hoping I can somehow get in contact with his management and get him to write a song about it.
Your parents did an adorable interview recently where they told the reporter about you as a kid. They said, she was the class secretary in high school. She loved high school. She was very organized and on committees. And I read that and I thought that could be a line directly out of Leslie's bio.
Yeah, certainly if you were to do a Venn diagram of Amy Poehler and Leslie Knope, there are a few things that you would find in the middle, and one of them is school activities and clubs. But there are a lot of things that Leslie and I do not share the same love for, like guns or camping, or Leslie finds Joe Biden attractive. I tend to maybe enjoy his politics.
Okay, so before we let you go, just a quick lightning round.
Okay,
all right.
I love lightning rounds.
Okay, what are you going to be for Halloween?
Nothing. I hate Halloween. I hate dressing up. I wear wigs, makeup, costumes every day. Halloween is like my least favorite holiday.
What song is on repeat on your iPod right now?
Adele.
Someone
Like You, yes.
All right.
That song is off the hook good, and it makes everybody feel like they can sing it well.
If you could play anyone in a biopic, who and why?
Christy McNichol and the Christy McNichol Story.
Explain.
There's no explanation needed for that, but let me think of something that your audience would appreciate, something a little bit more erudite.
You don't have to pander to the public
radio
audience.
No, please, NPR, allow me to. I would love to play Frank Gehry.
The architect.
The architect, of course.
And finally, what's on your DVR right now?
Up All Night, my husband's show, Parks and Recreation, constantly recording Law and Order. It's still the best show ever to fall asleep to. I usually get through the order. I'm asleep by the law.
So you watch your own show every week?
Yeah.
I kind of love that, you and your husband watching each other's shows together. That's really sweet.
Well, what else are we going to do? Not watch it? Listen, any actor or actress that tells you they don't watch their stuff is lying.
What a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry. That's how I'm going to end on. Well, maybe you can edit that out.
Amy Poehler plays Leslie Knope on NBC's Parks and Recreation. And the husband she just mentioned, that would be Will Arnett, who stars in Up All Night. This is NPR News.
Up next, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week.
Hi, Ira.
Seasonal?
Seasonal, less controversial than our last topic, because this week's video pick is about pumpkins.
Pumpkins. How could you not like a pumpkin?
I know.
How could it be controversial, a pumpkin?
Well, I don't know if it can be controversial, but these actually are no ordinary pumpkins. This is not your sort of typical jack-o'-lantern. We are talking jack-o'-lantern 2.0, designer pumpkins, call them what you will. These are really fancy pumpkins. We went and talked to master carvers. There are these two guys. They're living in, or they're working in Bushwick in Brooklyn. And in their basement, they have 50 pumpkins. They're carving hundreds of pumpkins every fall. And they end up as works of art.
Yeah, and they gave you some hints about how to carve a pumpkin. What to do the right way?
Yes. So there are a few things that we learned that I thought that kind of, you know, blew my pumpkin out of the water. A lot of things that I took for granted in carving.
Such as?
For example, when you're scooping it out, don't carve off the stem. Why? Because apparently the stem is providing the pumpkin some nutrients. So if you actually carve that hole where you're going to scoop out the seeds and stuff from the back, your pumpkin will last longer. So they don't carve the stem.
Don't get rid of this, and don't pick it up by the stem so it breaks off, right?
Another tip. They said they see it all the time, people picking it up by the stem. Don't do that.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Here with Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, talking about our new video pick of the week. It's up on our website. Gorgeous pumpkin carving. It's artwork, really.
It really
science
is
and art on this one.
It really is science and art. I mean, there are portraits. They have a very spectacular Michael Jackson portrait on one of the pumpkins that you can check out on the video.
And they have Michael Jackson. They have a special one related to the program.
And if that's not enough, they even have a Science Friday pumpkin there for us they carved on the spot. So let me give you some more tips,
okay,
because, you know, people
are
getting ready.
This is the season.
So one thing that they do, they don't really carve through the pumpkin. They etch, actually, and they keep the pulp there. So they carve first, they sort of etch it out, and it's going to be the photo negative, right, or the negative of this. So where they go deeper, it will be brighter. And one thing that they do is they carve first and then they scoop, and this is sort of another prolonging the lifespan. But this was my favorite tip. And this is one that you can do after you've carved the pumpkin.
There's little tricks that you can do to rejuvenate your pumpkin, too. You know, sometimes if you're making a salad and you have some limp lettuce or something in the fridge, you can shock it in some ice water. You can do that with a pumpkin. If it's starting to look a little sad, you fill a big bucket or tub with water and ice and plunge the pumpkin in there. If you leave it in there for a few hours, it'll really perk back up, and it's kind of awesome.
That was Mark from Maniac Pumpkin Carvers. He's one of the founders along with Chris. So I never knew that.
No.
Not that, I mean, most people feel that strongly about keeping their pumpkins.
Right. What do they say? What kind of light? You know, people put candles in there. They put light bulbs. What's the best thing?
This is truly a geek moment. They use candelabra CFLs. There's actually a wire coming out of the back of the pumpkin. And this gives them not only more light, but they've tried incandescents. And they said that when they put the incandescent in, it got really hot. And so it would start to smell like pumpkin pie, which was pleasant. But the pumpkins would just dissolve after a few days.
Very Benji. Very, very, very Benji.
Well, that's a word that, in case people aren't catching that's a word we've coined on Science Friday for geek.
Yes. Much better.
Benjamin
than geek.
Franklin.
Yes. Yeah,
so it's very Benji.
And so they gave you more hints? Any more hints?
Any more hints? One thing they do is they seal their pumpkins with Vaseline. I mean, this is really taking it to the next
level. This is geek. This is pumpkin geek, serious geek stuff.
And the reason that this has become important to them is because these pumpkins aren't cheap. I mean, each pumpkin is a couple $100, and so they don't really end up on the stoop usually. They're in advertisements. Tiffany's did an ad with a $3 million diamond in one of their pumpkins.
Whoa.
I know.
Hope they took the seeds out.
High, low, you know? It's very in. And they end up in Yankee Stadium and on album covers. So these are, you know, not your sort of typical thing. But I'm excited to go home and carve.
Yeah. And you watch them. If you want to see our video pick of the week, you want to see how these pumpkins are carved and what to do to prepare it, keep it fresh.
Give it a bath. That's another tip.
You need to wash it, right?
Because it could get infected. Just like if you're doing surgery on anything, you want to clean it first.
That's right. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. You guys laugh now, but you laugh even more when you see this video at Science Friday.
The laughing has just begun.
And it's funny, but it's also very geeky and very interesting. And it's so gorgeous. The artistry in this is amazing.
No, I mean, we should say, when I saw this, I was blown away. I definitely wasn't. I think what they do is really amazing. These guys are professional illustrators who basically turn their medium to pumpkin when October rolls around. And they do this mostly because they want to have an artistic project. It doesn't sound like they're, you know, making huge bucks.
And the photo, if you're on Facebook, it's SciFry Facebook page, you can also see the photo up there of the pumpkin and special edited photo of yours truly on the pumpkin coming up on the website. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Flora Lichtman, our video pick of the week. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Flora is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and spinning the dials here in New York. If you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. You can take that pumpkin podcast and put it on your iTunes. In audio and video, and also we have an Android app. You can take it along with you. Watch it anytime you'd like to. Yeah, it's kind of cool. You can also go to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can watch the video there also. And join our community all week on Facebook and become part of that community and sign up for that also. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatto in New York.
Why is Siri a female? Siri is the name of a new talking virtual assistant feature on the latest iPhone that can tell you when you have an appointment, where to find a Thai restaurant, and what the pollen count will be. I have friends who have the phone and love to ask Siri, what's the meaning of life?
Life, a principle or force that is considered to underlie the distinctive quality of animate beings. I guess that includes me.
Maybe it takes a circuit board to recognize the special quality of life. But frankly, her answer sounds a little robotic. Siri, which is an acronym for the California company that developed her, speaks in an electronically warm, friendly female voice. So do most onboard navigation systems, voicemail prompts, directory assistance greetings, and Julie, the voice of Amtrak's automated reservation system. Why are the voices that emanate from our machines so often female? Professor Clifford Nass of Stanford University told CNN.com that humans develop an affinity for female voices that begins when we overhear our mothers speaking while we wait in their wombs. We hear our mothers coo, "I love you," just over our heads, so a woman's voice conveys comfort and security. We might hear a man's voice somewhere in the background asking, "Have you seen my shoes? Do we have any of that peanut fudge ripple ice cream left? Hey, where are the spoons?" Researchers say that while a man's voice can sound authoritative, although Margaret Thatcher, Hillary Clinton, and, for that matter, Nina Totenberg sound plenty authoritative, a woman's voice may be taken as more congenial and cooperative. Rebecca Zorach, director of the Social Media Project at the University of Chicago's Center for the Study of Gender and Sexuality, says, "I wouldn't automatically claim any sexism," and suggests that companies are probably only choosing the voice that focus groups and market surveys like most. It's casting, she says. Professor Nass at Stanford also points out that male mechanized voices have played the heavy ever since the HAL 9000 computer in Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey, which came out in 1968. HAL speaks soothingly, but locks astronauts out of their spaceship. Professor Nass says a lot of tech companies stayed away from the male voice because of HAL. In other words, typecasting. Because of HAL, a whole generation of male mechanical voices lost out on work. I don't want to begin any inclusion campaign for more male mechanical voices. I prefer to think that the proliferation of female robotic voices reflects some of the progress actual women have won in the struggle for equality. Women have achieved so much in so many ways, you can hear it everywhere. By the way, you've got mail, I think. Maybe. You're listening to NPR News.